This is the second day of this two-day September 2012 session. I'm going to continue reading from this book, Everything Arises, Everything Falls Away, Teachings on Impermanence and the End of Suffering by Ajahn Chah. It's actually translated by Paul Breiter. And I'm going to pick up here a section that's called Understanding Dukkha. For anybody who doesn't know, dukkha is the Sanskrit word for dissatisfactory, for pain, for suffering. A lot of different translations that have been made. I don't think I said this yesterday, but the word dukkha, been told, I think by Roshi or by Roshi Kaplow, it comes from, it is a Sanskrit word, but its root is it's the image of a wheel whose axle, the axle is not exactly in the center. So it's got that sort of association of being slightly out of joint. I always think a good image for dukkha is chewing tinfoil. So he says, dukkha sticks on the skin and goes into the flesh. From the flesh, it gets into the bones. It's like an insect on a tree that eats through the bark, into the wood, and then into the core until finally the tree dies. As we grow up, it gets buried deep inside. Our parents teach us grasping and attachment, giving meaning to things, believing firmly that we exist as a self-entity and that things belong to us. From our birth, that's what we're taught. I read this, I remember sitting at the table with my precocious granddaughter, Isabel, and her parents, and all of a sudden she looked up brightly and she pointed and said, "Mommy, Daddy, Izzy." So adorably cute and so fraught with future pain. He says, we hear this over and over again and it penetrates our hearts and stays there as our habitual feeling. We're taught to get things, to accumulate and to hold on to them, to see them as important and as ours. This is what our parents know and this is what they teach us. So it gets into our minds and into our bones. When we take an interest in meditation and hear the teaching of a spiritual guide, it's not easy to understand. It doesn't really grab us. We're taught not to see and do things the old way, but when we hear this, it doesn't penetrate our hearts. So we sit and listen to teachings, but it's often just sound entering the ears. It doesn't get inside and affect us. It's like we're boxing and we keep hitting the other guy, but he doesn't go down. We remain stuck in our self-view. The wise have said that moving a mountain from one place to another is easier than moving the conceit of self-view, this solid feeling that we really exist as some special individual. This is not a feeling that is banished with an initial insight. Someone who comes to Kensho still gets caught up in self-view. It's a very advanced state when we get past it. I take that on faith. Ramana Maharshi said something that sort of bears on this. He was asked by a questioner what was the correct attitude that one should bring. The word is bhavana. What attitude one should bring to practice, to inquiry. And he said, you need not have any attitude in the mind. All that is required is you must give up the attitude that you are the body of such and such a name, etc. There is no need to have an attitude about your real nature. It exists as it always does. It is real and no attitude. Again, there's not something that we have to get or add on, something we have to get rid of. Even short of an exalted state where there is no self-concept, just practicing, even short of awakening, practicing over some length of time, we do find that the ego lightens a bit. It does become lighter. It's not so much to protect. We're not quite as armored. We're a little more porous. Take other people in a little better. Feel what other people feel more easily. Not thrown quite as much when we're criticized or things don't go our way. Really is one of the real fruits of practice is just not being all that. Screw up and we say, yep, I screwed up. There it is. Doesn't mean we don't want to fix it. But what we're not concerned with fixing is our reputation. Not as worried about other people seeing us, seeing our shortcomings. He says, we can use explosives to level a mountain and then move the earth, but the tight grasping of self-conceit, oh man, our wrong ideas and bad tendencies remain so solid and unbudging, and we're not aware of them. This is so true. We're just not at all aware of how deluded we are. It's moment to moment we keep forgetting, keep getting sucked in. So the wise have said that removing this view and turning wrong understanding into right understanding is about the hardest thing to do. For us who are worldly beings, to progress on to being virtuous beings is not easy. A worldly being is one who is thickly obscured, who is dark, who is stuck deep in this darkness and obscuration. The virtuous being has made things lighter. We teach people to lighten, but they don't want to do that because they don't understand their situation, their condition of obscuration. Anybody who doesn't know that word, it just means darkness. So they keep on drifting in their confused state. If we come across a pile of buffalo dung, we don't think it's ours and we don't want to pick it up. We'll just leave it where it is because we know what it is. Such is the nature of what's good in the way of the impure. That which is evil is the food of bad people. If you teach them about doing good, they're not interested, but prefer to stay as they are because they don't see the harm in it. Without seeing the harm, there's no way things can be rectified. If you recognize it, then you think, oh, my whole pile of dung doesn't have the value of a small piece of gold, and you will want gold instead. You won't want the dung anymore. If you don't recognize this, you remain the owner of a pile of dung. Teach them about doing good. If you teach them about doing good, they're not interested, but prefer to stay as they are because they don't see the harm in it. People are sometimes even proud of their vindictiveness. Proudly say, don't get mad, get even. Take pride in getting revenge. In nursing a grudge. I love that phrase, nursing a grudge. Just like a mother holding a baby to its breast. Coming back and back again and again to whatever we think was done wrong to us. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, he beat me, he abused me, he robbed me, he defeated me. He defeated me, he robbed me. Those who dwell on such thoughts will never be free from hatred. He beat me, he abused me, he defeated me, he robbed me. Those who do not dwell on such thoughts will surely become free from hatred. For hatred can never put an end to hatred. Love alone can. This is an unalterable law. People forget that their lives will end soon. For those who remember, quarrels come to an end. Going back to Ajahn Chah, gold, jewels, and diamonds are considered something good in the realm of humans. The foul and rotten are good for flies and other insects. If you gather fresh flowers, the flies won't be interested in them. Even if you tried to pay them, they wouldn't come. But wherever there's a dead animal, wherever there's something rotten, that's where they'll go. Wrong view is like that. It delights in that kind of thing. What's sweet-smelling to a bee is not sweet to a fly. There's difficulty in practice, but in anything we undertake, we have to pass through difficulty to reach ease. It's really true of any kind of practice. This is true of learning to ride a bike, learning to ice skate, learning to ski, certainly learning to sit. We have to pass through difficulty to reach ease. In Dharma practice, we begin with the truth of dukkha, the pervasive unsatisfactoriness of existence. But as soon as we experience this, we lose heart. We don't want to look at it. Dukkha is really the truth, but we want to get around it somehow. It's similar to the way we don't like to look at old people, but prefer to look at the young and attractive. I remember reading an article by Roshi Kaplow when I first came to the center way back when. He talked about seeing the beauty in an angry face. It was hard for me to conceive what he was talking about. But old people are beautiful. At least other old people are. If we don't want to look at dukkha, we will never understand dukkha no matter how long we live. Dukkha is truth. If we allow ourselves to face it, then we will start to seek a way out of it. If we're trying to go somewhere and the road is blocked, we will think about how to make a pathway. Working at it day after day, we can get through. When we encounter problems, we develop wisdom like this. Without seeing dukkha, we don't really look into and resolve our problems. We just bear with them or pass them by indifferently. Without problems, without suffering, where would we be? I'm going to read something now. I can never resist throwing in a little Anthony DeMello. This is right on this whole topic. This little section in his book, Awareness, entitled Dead Ahead. It says, I've often said to people that the way to really live is to die. The passport to living is to imagine yourself in your grave. Imagine that you're lying in your coffin, any posture you like. In India, we put them in cross-legged. Sometimes they're carried that way to the burning ground. Sometimes, though, they're lying flat. So imagine you're lying flat and you're dead. Now look at your problems from that viewpoint. It changes everything, doesn't it? What a lovely, lovely meditation. Do it every day if you have the time. It's unbelievable, but you'll come alive. You see the body decomposing, then bones, then dust. Every time I talk about this, people say, "How disgusting." But what's so disgusting about it? It's reality, for heaven's sake. But many of you don't want to see reality. You don't want to think of death. People don't live. Most of you, you don't live. You're just keeping the body alive. That's not life. You're not living until it doesn't matter a tinker's damn to you whether you live or die. At that point, you live. When you're ready to lose your life, you live it. But if you're protecting your life, you're dead. If you're sitting up there in the attic and I say to you, "Come on down," and you say, "Oh no, I've read about people going downstairs. They slip and they break their necks. It's too dangerous. Or I can't get you to cross the street," because you say, "You know how many people get run over when they cross the street? If I can't get you to cross a street, how can I get you to cross a continent? And if I can't get you to peep out of your little narrow beliefs and convictions and look at another world, you're dead. You're completely dead. Life has passed you by. You're sitting in your little prison where you're frightened. You're going to lose your God, your religion, your friends, all kinds of things. Life is for the gambler. It really is. That's what Jesus was saying. Are you ready to risk it? Do you know when you're ready to risk it? When you've discovered that, when you know that this thing that people call life is not really life. People mistakenly think that living is keeping the body alive. So love the thought of death. Love it. Go back to it again and again. Think of the loveliness of that corpse, of that skeleton, of those bones crumbling till there's only a handful of dust. From there on, what a relief. What a relief. Some of you probably don't know what I'm talking about at this point. You're too frightened to think of it. But it's such a relief when you can look back on life from that perspective. Or visit a graveyard. It's an enormously purifying and beautiful experience. You look at this name and you say, "Gee, he lived so many years ago, 2 centuries ago. He must have had all the problems that I have, must have had lots of sleepless nights. How crazy. We live for such a short time." An Italian poet said, "We live in a flash of light. Evening comes, and it is night forever." It's only a flash, and we waste it. We waste it with our anxiety, our worries, our concerns, our burdens. Now, as you make that meditation, you can end up just with information, but you may end up with awareness. And in that moment of awareness, you're new, at least as long as it lasts. Then you'll know the difference between information and awareness. Caught up in our anxieties, our worries. Who doesn't worry more than they need to? Who doesn't pay interest on that debt that never comes due? Who doesn't shrink from suffering? Back to Ajahn Chah. My way of training people involves some suffering because understanding suffering is the Buddha's path to enlightenment. He wanted us to see suffering, to see its origination, its cessation, and the path that brings about cessation. Of course, those are the Four Noble Truths. This is the way out for all the awakened ones. If you don't go this way, there is no way out. opposing our habits creates some suffering. This is anybody who's made any effort at all to change their habits knows this. Even changing little habits. There was one term intensive where I decided I would stop listening to the radio in the car, driving the car. All I had to do was just leave the radio off. And I would forget, and my hand would be halfway to the knob, and then there was a little bit of pain not to turn the radio on, just to, nope. I think it can be way more painful. There can be giving up drugs or other really deeply entrenched habits, addictions. Tremendously painful. The pain is usually sort of proportional to our ambivalence. When we really know clearly this is something I cannot do again, it's easier than when we're saying this is something I probably shouldn't do, I'm going to try not to do this. You know, lots of luck with that. Sometimes we have to stumble around and make mistakes again and again before we finally come to that realization, no, never again. We're works in progress. When people come to a workshop, you know, Roshi warns them, don't try to give up everything all at once. Don't try to suddenly start sitting 2 hours a day and give up TV and reading books and other habits you think may not be helpful. And Roshi Kaplow used to say to people who wanted to become vegetarians, don't give up meat, let meat give you up. It's don't want to tell somebody, eat meat, but you need to be ready, you need to get ready. The main thing is to be awake, be aware, to see what's going on, to understand how our little pet habits are affecting us, to experiment, to have a little bit of willingness to risk things and try giving something up for a few days. You don't have to give it up forever, and see what happens. Is your mind clearer? Are you happier? Do you relate to people better? Eventually we can find our way, but there needs to be some real drive, some real determination, which comes from seeing things as they are. That's why it is important to look at the bad news. It's funny, you know, in Christianity they have the gospel, the good news. We've got the bad news. Although, to be fair to the Buddha, once you get a little more deeply into the Four Noble Truths, there is a way that leads from suffering, so I guess that's our good news. It says, generally, we are afraid of suffering, and if something will make us suffer, we don't want to do it. We are interested in what appears to be good and beautiful, and we feel that anything involving suffering is bad. But it's not like that. If there is suffering in the heart, it becomes the cause that makes you think about escaping. It leads you to contemplate. You will be intent on investigating to find out what is really going on, trying to see causes and their results. He says, happy people don't develop wisdom. They're asleep. It's like a dog that eats its fill. After that, it doesn't want to do anything. It can sleep all day. It won't bark if a burglar comes. It's too full and too tired. But if you only give it a little food, it will be alert and awake. If someone comes sneaking around, it'll jump up and start barking. Have you seen that? At some level, even for people who are pretty pappy, you know, pretty much, I remember coming into practice and thinking, maybe I'm not unhappy enough. But as you go on in practice, you realize there's something that's not enough. There's something that's not quite right. You may be happy for the most part, but there's that longing. Need to be reunited. Come back to our true home. We all at some level, maybe buried deep, we all long to return home. He says, we humans are trapped and imprisoned in this world and have troubles in such abundance, and we are always full of doubt, confusion, and worry. This is no game. So there's something we need to get rid of. According to the way of spiritual cultivation, we should give up our bodies, give up ourselves. We have to resolve to give our lives in the pursuit of liberation. Sounds so daunting, to give up our body, to give up ourselves. But this is really an excellent deal. This is a good deal. What we're giving up is the source of our problems. It's like DeMello says, we have to be willing to gamble. Can't sit protecting ourselves. Got to play to win. It says, if we speak the subtle Dharma, most people will be frightened by it. They won't dare to enter it. Even saying, don't do evil, most people can't follow this. So I've sought all kinds of means to get this across, and one thing I often say is, no matter if we are delighted or upset, happy or suffering, shedding tears or singing songs, never mind, living in this world, we are living in a cage. We don't get beyond this condition of being in a cage. Even if you are rich, you are living in a cage. If you are poor, you are living in a cage. If you sing and dance, you're singing and dancing in a cage. If you watch a movie, you're watching it in a cage. What is this cage? It's the cage of birth, the cage of aging, the cage of illness, the cage of death. In this way, we are imprisoned in the world. This is mine. That belongs to me. We don't know what we really are or what we're doing. Actually, all we are doing is accumulating suffering for ourselves. It's not something far away that causes our suffering, but we don't look at ourselves. However much happiness and comfort we may have, having been born, we cannot avoid aging. We must fall ill, and we must die. This is dukkha itself, here and now. Here and now. The time we can be afflicted with pain or illness is always. It can happen at any moment. Roshi says, the certainty of death and the uncertainty about the moment of death. The same with pain or illness. It's like we've stolen something. We could be arrested at any time because we've done that. That's our situation. We exist among harmful things, among danger and trouble. Aging, illness, and death reign over our lives. We can't go elsewhere and escape them. They can come catch us at any time. It's always a good opportunity for them. So we have to cede this to them and accept the situation. We have to plead guilty. If we do, the sentence won't be so heavy. If we don't, we suffer enormously. If we plead guilty, they'll go easy on us. We won't be incarcerated too long. We recognize that these things are inevitable. It's not such a shock. We get sick. We suffer pain. As we said yesterday, that's about right. When the body is born, it doesn't belong to anyone. It's like our meditation hall. After it's built, spiders come to stay in it. Lizards come to stay in it. All sorts of insects and crawling things come to stay in it. Snakes may come to live in it. Anything may come to live in it. It's not only our hall, it's everything's hall. Here at Chapin Mill, spiders come to live in it. mice come to live in it. Weird little segmented worms come to live in it. Usually only in the summer. Then in the winter you come across a little discarded, curled up body. Our bodies are the same. They aren't ours. We come to stay in and depend on them. Illness, pain, and aging come to reside in them, and we are merely residing along with them. When these bodies reach the end of pain and illness and finally break up and die, that is not us dying. So don't hold on to any of this, but contemplate clearly, and your grasping will gradually be exhausted. I'm going to skip ahead to another section. It's titled, Don't Be a Buddha. It says, no matter what kind of dharma we learn, if we don't realize the ultimate truth in our hearts, we won't reach satisfaction. An apple is something you can see with your eyes. You can't know the flavor of the apple by looking at it, but you do see the apple. You can't see the flavor, but it's there. You can only know it when you pick up the apple and eat it. The Dharma we teach is like the apple. Merely hearing it, people don't really know the flavor. When they practice, then it can be known. It's even short of awakening. When we really get into our practice, we begin to get a sense. This other way. The flavor of the apple can't be known by the eyes, and the truth of the Dharma can't be known by the ears. There is knowledge, true, but it doesn't reach the actuality. Or as DeMello says, we have information, but we don't yet have awareness. One has to put it into practice. Then wisdom arises, and one recognizes the ultimate truth directly. One sees the Buddha there. So I compare it to an apple in this way. In order to help his disciples realize the Dharma, the Buddha taught a single path, but with different approaches and characteristics. He didn't use only one form of teaching or present the Dharma in the same way for everyone, but he taught for the single purpose of realizing ultimate truth and transcending suffering. All the meditations he taught were for this one purpose. This is what all practice has in common. So many different ways that one can practice. Zen, Vipassana, Tibetan Buddhism, other religious traditions, other practices. But in the end, they're all for this one purpose, to realize the truth, to transcend suffering. He says, because people don't look at themselves, they don't really know what's going on in life. How do you stop this delusion? People believe this is me, this is mine. If you tell them about not self, that nothing is me or mine, they immediately want to argue the point. Even the Buddha, after he attained awakening, felt weary at heart when he considered this. When he was first enlightened, he thought it would be too hard to explain the way to others. But then he realized that such an attitude was mistaken. According to the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, he sat under the tree for 49 days after he came to his great awakening. For, I think the god Brahman came to him and told him, there are some whose minds are only lightly covered by delusion. Ajahn Chah says, if we don't teach such people, who will we teach? This is my question, which I used to ask myself at those times I got fed up and didn't want to teach anymore. Who should we teach if we don't teach the deluded? There's really nowhere else to go. When we get fed up and want to run away from others, we are deluded. Then a student asked him, how about if we aspire to be Pachika Buddhas, the solitary realizers who attain enlightenment without a teacher and don't teach others? Ajahn Chah replied, such terms are merely metaphors for states of mind, but being something is a burden. Don't be anything. Don't be anything at all. Being a Buddha is a burden. Being a Pachika, if I'm pronouncing that right, is a burden. Just don't desire to be. I am Mr. Smith. I am a venerable monk. That way is suffering, believing that you really exist thus. Mr. Smith is merely a convention. Monk is merely a convention. If you believe you really exist, that brings suffering. If there is Mr. Smith, then when someone criticizes him, Mr. Smith gets angry. That's what happens if we hold these things to be real. Mr. Smith gets involved and is ready to fight. If there's no Mr. Smith, then there's no one there. No one to answer the telephone. Ring, ring. Nobody picks it up. You don't become anything. No one is being anything, and there is no suffering. Just to get a taste of that is so wonderful. What is there that needs to be protected and defended? He says, once a monk came to me and he urgently confided, Ajahn, I have attained stream entry. That's in his system the first level of enlightenment. We could say, I've come to Kensho. All I could think to say was, well, that's a little better than being a dog, I guess. And there's a little, I think this is the translator's comment, calling someone a dog is among the worst of insults in Thailand and not done lightly by anyone. So he says, he didn't like that, and he went away in a great huff. The stream enterer was angry. There's a story, probably many of you have heard it. There was a well-known Chinese poet, a Song Dynasty poet named Su Tung Po, who was great friends with a Chan master who lived on the other side of the river from him named Fo Ying. And one day Su Tung Po came across on a boat across the river, and Fo Ying, the master, wasn't there. He waited around for a while and got kind of bored and scribbled some verses down and then signed them, Su Tung Po, the great Buddhist who cannot be moved even by the combined forces of the mighty eight worldly winds. Of course, the eight worldly winds are things like gain and loss, joy and sorrow, praise and blame. So the master came back and found the note, and he just wrote on it, this isn't worth a fart, and sent it across the river. And when the poet got it, he was just incensed, and he came storming across the river and said, we've known each other for so long, you know I'm an ardent Buddhist, sincere in my aspiration, how could you write such a thing? And the master smiled and said, Su Tung Po, the great poet who cannot be moved by the eight worldly winds, has been blown across the river by a puff of wind from the anus. We all get caught, though. If we believe ourselves to be something or someone, then every time the phone rings, we pick it up and get involved. How can we free ourselves of this? We have to look at it clearly and develop wisdom, so there is no Mr. Smith to pick up the telephone. If you are Mr. Smith and you answer the phone, you will get yourself involved in suffering. So don't be Mr. Smith. Just recognize that these names and titles are on the level of convention. If someone calls you good, don't be that. Don't think, I'm good. If someone says you are bad, don't think, I'm bad. Don't try to be anything. Know what is taking place. But then don't attach to that knowledge either, thinking, I am someone who is aware. Anytime we think we're anything, We're taking our eye off the ball. It's the same with being critical of your practice. If you think, oh, my concentration is so weak, or just have that negative feeling, all that is just separating yourself from your practice. If it worked, we would recommend it as a method of practice, self-flagellation. Yeah. The self-criticism school. But it doesn't. It doesn't seem to work. Certainly has not worked for me. It's just, why get involved? Why decide this is good or bad? The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. Preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. Almost out of time. I'm going to skip here to the end of this passage. Born of the womb, can we avoid death? Apart from realizing that there is no real self, there is no way to avoid death. I don't die. Conditioned phenomena undergo transformation following their nature. When others look at such a person who understands this, and try to figure him out, they will probably see someone who's crazy. But this isn't a mad person. This is someone who is diligent. Such a person really knows what is useful in so many different ways. When an awakened being looks at ordinary, worldly people, she will see them as ignorant, like little children. When worldly people consider an awakened being, they will think she's lost it. She doesn't have any interest in the things they live for. To put it another way, an arhat and an insane person are similar. When people look at an arhat, they'll think she's crazy. If you curse her, she doesn't care. Whatever you say to her, she doesn't react, like a crazy person, but crazy and having awareness. A truly insane person may not get angry when she's cursed, but that's because she doesn't know what's going on. Someone observing the arhat and the mad person might see them as the same, but the lowest is mad, living in a condition of intense self-cherishing, while the very highest is the arhat, free of all ideas of and concerns about a self. If you only look at their external manifestations, they may seem similar, but their inner awareness, their sense of things, is very different. Think about this. When someone says something that ought to make you angry and you just let it go, people might believe you're crazy. So when you teach others about these things, they don't understand very easily. It has to be internalized and experienced directly for them really to understand. Wonderful practice to let go. So much of practice comes down to that. It's the things that we hold on to that get in our way. There's nothing else in the way. If you're blocked, there's something you're holding on to. It's habitual, it's bread in the bone. So it's hard to loosen that grasp, but it does loosen. We do see it. So totally worth doing. There's not a whole lot of time left in Sesshin. Always want to remind people, this makes such a difference to keep your efforts going right to the end of Sesshin. I've tried both systems. I've tried coasting to the end, and I've tried working to the end, and there's no comparison. It's hard to do. There's so many thoughts can begin to come into the mind, creep into the mind, things that are going to happen, things we're going to do. But we deal with them just like we deal with them at any time. You see them, let them go. If there are a lot of them, you're going to be doing a lot of seeing and letting go, but it's still the same. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.